Welcome to this third and final portion of today's seminar regarding transforming trauma. We've talked about several interesting things to this point and wanted to give you a few other different considerations and approaches that could also be used when we're talking about dealing with trauma. One of the exercises that clients have found interesting is the one that I've entitled in the PowerPoints, Dealing with the Little Inner You. Oftentimes there's inner childhood work or inner child unresolved kind of issues from family of origin that can be helpful for someone to process through. Sometimes writing in our non-dominant hand in present tense language can be very emotion producing in terms of writing as if we are that little inner child asking and stating what we need. For example, I might write, Mom, Dad, I need you to pay attention to me, to let me have awe and wonder. I need you to let me explore, to make things, to build things, to try different things, even when I mess things up or get things messy. I need you to let me make mistakes and not have to be good, strong, and perfect in every way. So the key again is using present tense language. That tends to bring the emotions, the concerns, and things to the forefront and make them very real. This is something you could use with the supplement of the Gestalt technique of the empty chair as well. And then in response, using the hand you typically write with, your dominant hand, you could write back a response that could be affirming of that little inner child's needs. Another sort of technique that can be very helpful in terms of processing and working through of trauma can be that of acceptance and commitment therapy, abbreviated ACT. With acceptance and commitment therapy, there's a focus on values. I've made an extensive list based on a 2019 article that I've referenced of the types of values that many people may find meaningful. I found that in exercises with clients, this has been really useful in terms of discussion, finding out what are the meaningful core goals they might have in life or things they'd like to work towards or things they might use as a judgment for or against who they are. Things like, if they have a strong sense of ambition, or they have a strong need for belonging, or caring, or commitment, or cooperation. Other things like competency, curiosity, or courage. Maybe they have a value on faith, or certain types of friendships or relationships. Maybe there's a value on things like harmony, happiness, home life, integrity, justice, love, loyalty, optimism. But you see, and I encourage you to go through these PowerPoints because they're quite extensive. I mean, I've listed about 8 or 10 of them alphabetically with a whole range of different values. And the key in going through and discussing these with a client is to help understand his or her operational definitions of these values. What I typically tell a client is that oftentimes we use these words like love, respect, friendship, competency, ambition, and we assume that many people mean the same thing when they're exchanging those words. But the fact is, it's really important to get the operational definition of the client because they may mean it in a somewhat different way than someone else in their life may mean. And sometimes it can be very life-giving when we're doing treatment with the client to help them focus on how they define these values. That way, we can then build up that client and help him or her find small, meaningful goals and steps that are realistic and rational towards those values. It's one thing, for example, for a client to say he or she has a value or a strong value, an emphasis on justice. But if they have that, it would be important for us to know what that looks like to him or her. And then are there steps that they could actually be taking towards those goals? What would that look like? Are there things they're actively doing, for example, in the community towards the goal of justice? Could they be writing some articles? Could they be contacting people and lawmaking? Could they be emphasizing things with social justice and reform in the community? So if there are values, I think this can be an area where our clients can really feel empowered. And that is one thing we want to do, is move them beyond the initial stuckness of the presenting concern and the helplessness they oftentimes come to us with surrounding trauma, and really make it transforming, where we're helping them see that they can actively pursue these values that are meaningful for them. Another way of doing this is looking at, what does a client really want to be remembered for? This could be another way of assessing his or her values. And one thing I frequently tell clients is that avoiding pain is not necessarily the same as pursuing pleasure. So oftentimes clients will say, I don't want to necessarily be remembered for all the junk I've gotten through life with. But they may have active goals that they want to be remembered for. Maybe they've changed lives. Maybe they have optimism. Maybe they're courageous. Maybe they've had a gift or a talent. So again, when we look at what do they want to be remembered for, that may help them refocus on their values. Gratitude is another wonderful area that we can cultivate with clients. We can help them look at what someone or a few people in their lives have done that have really impacted or made a difference. This builds on that restorative narrative that we talked about with narrative therapy. Perhaps you might want to encourage them to actually write a gratitude letter to someone who's made a difference in their life. Maybe they could think about, what does this person do that actually helps them? How do those behaviors that this person does make a difference? What do they value about that person? What do they enjoy doing together with that person? And how do they feel when they're around that person? Another variation of that I've done with clients is to keep a journal, basically a gratitude journal, that would look at finding the good and what's felt maybe not so good or pleasant all the time. Additionally, I love using strengths-based solution-focused therapy because this focuses on areas where the client has managed, where they've developed skills, where they've learned to deal with change, to modify, to be flexible, to learn skills, to adapt in ways they previously may not have given themselves credit for. So one of the things that we can do is look through their strengths, and I call this the My Strengths exercise. It could be things like, are they adventurous? Are they ambitious, artistic, athletic? What about charming or communicative, compassionate? Do they tend to have common sense and good reasoning about things? What about confidence or courage? Creativity, critical thinking, or curiosity. These are a little bit different than the values we just referred to a little bit ago, but you might see some overlapping. The values may be the things that they admire and that they proactively want to pursue. But the strengths could be skills that they've already evidenced that sometimes they might even have a tendency to minimize. The idea with doing the My Strengths exercise is, again, to really reiterate to the client in many different ways throughout the course of therapy that there's more in you than you give yourself credit for. You have dealt with change before. You have managed something. You might not feel like a survivor. You might feel like anything but a survivor. But yet, there's these certain areas that you've evidenced some of these personality traits. This goes to the heart of what resiliency is. That resiliency isn't necessarily just inborn innate traits. They used to think at one point about dispositional traits, but now we know there's some people who may not necessarily earlier on in their lives have had these dispositions very strongly. But through life, they've learned to develop some of these. Let's look at some of the other potential strengths that some of our clients may have developed. Things like determination, being energetic or enthusiastic, fairness, flexibility, being focused, being friendly, generous, having gratitude, helpfulness, honesty, hope, or humility. What about others like humor, independence, being industrious, inspirational, integrity or intelligence, kindness, knowledge, leadership, liveliness, logic, being loving, being a person who loves learning, being modest, motivation. There's so many of these things, like being observant, open-minded, optimistic, orderly, having organizational skills, originality, being outgoing, patient, persevering, persistent, persuasive, precise, problem-solving, respectful, self-assurant, self-controlled, serious, having social skills, spirituality, straightforwardness, being tactful, being team-oriented, thoughtful, thrifty, tolerant, trustworthy, warm, having willpower or wisdom. What I hope strikes you as I'm reading these is just how many of them there are, that as I read them, I'm thinking, even if initially in one's emotions, they might easily feel like, huh, what do I have? Eventually, unless there's something they can find a little bit of, in spite of the initial sense that they don't have many strengths. So one of the things that over time clients could do is learning to take in their experiences as if they're a third-party observer. This is where the acceptance and commitment therapy is very strong. This is the heart of acceptance. Just learning to hold on to the experiences lightly. See them in the here and now. Go through them. Release control over trying to understand everything, over trying to sort through, and just seeing things in the moment. Another thing that we could do with clients that oftentimes is meaningful is really to make a list of ways that we can move them towards behavior change. So looking at the positive efforts they've already made or other additional behavioral efforts that can be made from here. Things like use of self-help books, positive self-talk, therapy, finding strengths, using medications if they need to be, of course, as prescribed. Things like AA or Al-Anon, spirituality, having healthy support systems, exercising, eating healthy, boundaries and limits, gathering information, mindfulness. One of the things we really want to highlight with the person who says they're a victim of trauma is that this idea of trying to control things really works against him or her. Think about when you tell yourself, don't think of such and such. If I say, don't think of pink elephants, that's probably the first thing you think of. So what happens is without even intending to do it, the trauma victim ends up shifting to a life that's actually centered more around trauma. So they end up having frantic efforts to avoid triggers. By doing so, they tend to define themselves even in light of the trauma. So one of the things we want to do is help them make a shift away from this. I'm going to read to you a lead-in that one of the resources out there said that could help when we work with clients that could benefit from acceptance and commitment therapy. What we might say to the client might go something like what I'm going to say now. Let's say you're experiencing anxiety. Perhaps you're challenging yourself in some way, and the feeling of anxiety comes up. Being willing is about noticing the anxious feeling and letting it be there, rather than engaging in various control or avoidance strategies. This doesn't mean you want to be anxious. Who wants to be anxious? That would not even be natural. But willingness, in this case, means allowing yourself to have the feeling of anxiety at that moment without trying to change or escape it in the moment. What we're trying to do over time and over the course of therapy, as the client feels comfortable, is to promote a sense of functionality. In the article I referenced from 2019, it talks about the five freedoms. The freedoms to see and hear what is, to say and feel and think, to feel what you feel, to ask for what you want, and to take risks and not rock the and be willing to rock the boat. Another functionality element is unfolding authentic intimacy. That can be a challenge because for a lot of our clients who have dealt with trauma, one of the go-tos for many of them is that distrust and suspicion of people. But to actually learn to be real with someone, to hear them, to listen, to paraphrase, or to potentially put themselves in another's shoes can be challenging. That's why what we do in the therapeutic exchange and relationship is key. Because if they can learn these things on a certain level with us, and we can demonstrate it towards them, then it may be able, overall, through the course of time, to generalize to other relationships. Another way that functionality can be promoted is by helping clients negotiate differences. So helping demonstrate fairness and cooperation, an ability to work through things, and by fostering clear and consistent communication through use of things like iMessages, speaking from their point of view, hearing rather than listening, perspective taking, testing out faulty assumptions, and making behavioral requests. Functionality can also be highlighted by creating an emotionally safe environment by building trust. We may want to talk with the client for a while about his or her internal subjective definitions of trust, what it is or hasn't been for them, and what they would like to see it be. Functionality is also promoted by allowing each person to give his or her own perspective and have some openness and flexibility. It also is fostered by creating an environment where people can ask for their needs and each person knows that he or she will have some giving and receiving of needs. There's accountability with responsibility and ownership, and there's guidelines to deal with mistakes and correct wrongs. What I think is fascinating in the literature is that it's not just talking about taking someone from being a trauma victim to a survivor, which is healing in and of itself, but possibly even that trauma victim moving beyond the role of survivor to a thriver. let's notice what some of the differences can be. When a client comes to us, let's assume they're in the victim stance. They may feel they don't deserve nice things. Now, when they start to get the idea that they're more of a survivor, they may struggle for reasons and a chance to heal. But a thriver finds gratitude even in the small things in life. They find the good. That's why that gratitude journal can be so helpful. A victim has a sense of shame. They don't just feel like they did wrong, but they feel like they are wrong. Survivor might see themselves as wounded, but a thriver sees himself as an overflowing miracle. Look what they've survived. Look what they've moved beyond. Look where they're at this point, that they have choices and options, and they actually can influence their own narrative. The victim may feel hypervigilant. Think of the very definition of PTSD, for example. A survivor may be willing to use tools to learn to relax, but a thriver has gratitude for even having an opportunity to have a new life. Victims tend to feel alone. There's a sense of isolation, even if there's others around them. A survivor may have taken some steps toward seeking help. The thriver finds oneness. The victim feels selfish for even asking for anything for their needs. A survivor realizes, hey, I deserve to seek help just as much as the next person. And a thriver actively promotes seeking for his or her own self-care and realizes what I tell clients often, that self-care is not selfish. It's hard to give out of an empty well. It's important to demonstrate self-care to be able to interact effectively often with others. A victim may come to us feeling damaged. A survivor may name what happened as if things happened to them. But a thriver sees that in spite of what's happened, they have been wounded, but now they're moving towards healing. A victim may be stuck in that place of confusion and numbness. A survivor is in the area of learning to grieve. And a thriver grieves current losses as they occur and allows for the freedom for their individual style of grief, whatever that means. At one moment, that may mean openly talking about things. Another moment, it may mean being quiet and withdrawing or time to themselves. Victims tend to be overwhelmed by their past. Survivors can name and talk about, can dialogue or share the narrative with people about what they've gone through. But a thriver can live in the present moment, not being solely determined by what has happened to them. For this reason, they have faith in themselves and life. Initially, victims may be hopeless. Survivors may become more hopeful over time, but thrivers have that faith. Victims use the outer world to hide from themselves. Survivors, for a while, may be kind of stuck with that emotional pain as part of their self-identity. But thrivers realize that pain is temporary and that nothing stays painful forever. If you remember years ago, Martin Seligman talking about the concept of learned helplessness, and how some people just came to expect pain. One of the things that thrivers learn over time is that pain is never permanent, that eventually over time something good will happen, and that I can seek and try and find and be thankful for good things, even when they might feel small. Victims hide their story, whereas survivors are not afraid to tell their story. And thrivers go beyond just telling the story to even being able to listen with an open heart to others. Initially, the people who are victims may believe that everyone else is better off than them. They may do a lot of comparison. where survivors come out of hiding to hear and have compassion for others. Victims start off feeling wounded by unsafe others. They might not do so well in terms of picking and choosing relationships. Over time, survivors may develop skills about learning how to protect themselves. And thrivers become more assertive about proactively choosing which people to get in a relationship with. Victims place their own needs last. Survivors learn to verbalize their needs. And thrivers learn that you have to place your own needs first to effectively be able to help others. Imagine the sense of emotional peace that a thriver would experience compared to a victim or a survivor. A victim might believe that suffering is just what you get as a human, whereas survivors feel some sense of release and relief. Thrivers feel joy and actual peace. Victims may have a tendency to be on the serious side, whereas survivors actually learn to start to laugh again. And thrivers might actually develop a sense of humor because they realize there are choices and there is flexibility in terms of how they want to react to things. So being in the victim mode can feel awful. It can really bind someone up to the past. But being a survivor can help them have increasing awareness of various dynamics and choose what dynamics they want to focus on. Thrivers can develop healthy boundaries around people, even if they're toxic. Healthy thrivers learn to live in the here and now. They develop a sense of aliveness. They feel authentic and connected. They may have a sense of personal spirituality, and they own the future as they move forward. I encourage you, as you hear these, to also consider listening to the audio about this person I interviewed regarding how she moved beyond PTSD, and listen to how she developed what I consider more of a survivor and moving forward into the thriver identity. As we wrap up, before we go to some case discussions, I just want to finish with this idea of the four therapeutic R's: recognizing, respect, regulating, and restoring. These are the four areas that some clinicians say really need to be targeted to be maximally effective in the work we do, transforming trauma with our clients. So this first part may be helping clients recognize the fight, flight, and freeze response, and see therapy as a container to help people work through. The second therapeutic R is that of respect, looking at how the client has tried to pursue safety and survive, and where the narrative comes from. Regulation is another therapeutic R, promoting connection, social engagement, and safety skills. And finally, that of restoring. That goes back to the narrative therapy that we talked about. We need to keep in mind, too, the importance of having self-care even for ourselves. If there's any unfinished business, whether you've been through something that you may see as traumatic or not, maybe there's just a memory or an emotion or something that some of your client's narrative hits on. Keep in mind that sometimes a side effect of what we do is compassion fatigue. So if you need to, I encourage you to not be afraid to seek out counseling for yourself. Otherwise, there may be a risk of burnout. Things like decreased compassion, emotional exhaustion, numbing, irritability, hopelessness, and confusion. Some of these same symptoms that our traumatized clients have. You may have a sense of some of the physical symptoms like body aches and headaches, health problems, or behavioral symptoms like checking the time, taking time off work frequently, having decreased productivity, becoming more judgmental in cases. Now, as we close this last portion of today's seminar, I wanted to look at some case examples and just brainstorm how we might be able to apply some of the things we talked about today. In this first case example, a few weeks ago, Maria and Amy's stepdad, Bob, suddenly left the home. He messaged their mom that he just could not do family anymore. Knowing their mom and the girls had been through so much emotional abuse and change, even prior to the mom's marriage with them, this seemed surprising. Early on, he repeatedly said he'd always be around, to be counted on, and would never leave them like they had experienced in the past. Since the sudden abandonment by their stepdad and seeing their mom struggle to find childcare and do basic tasks for them, Maria and Amy began having outbursts of anger. They would throw things at walls in the house to the point they even broke drywall. They broke several of their favorite toys. They became suspicious of even being apart from each other and had to go everywhere together. They also became excessively clingy to their mother, making it challenging for her to leave work for them to go to school. So, again, this reminds me of a number of our clients who have a history of broken relationships. So when they're coming to us saying they're fearing abandonment, they're fearing rejection, oftentimes it's because they have gone through some of that. Maybe they've lived through someone walking out on them. Maybe they've had broken promises. So on the one hand, they're thinking, gosh, why even trust again? Why be vulnerable? Vulnerability is an awful thing. And this is one of the targets that I think is really important for us to talk with our clients about. The idea that if they take a risk to be vulnerable, what might that mean for them? It is really scary. Because it's one thing us trying to even suggest or imply that someone allow for vulnerability, but it's a whole other thing to have even a remote concept of how in the world would I do this if it's not paid off in the past. There's definite grief that Maria and Amy still have to go through. We see them acting out behaviorally. And oftentimes they act, you know, people act out in a way, in a place where they feel the safest. So even though their mom may be acting safe with them, they may feel like, oh, you know, the only way they can deal with things is behaviorally. They may be caught between that push and pull of wanting to get close to people and wanting to push them apart. Let's look at this second example. You don't love me, screamed Diana. You just say that because you have to, she shouted, after falsely accusing her parents of beating her, just like the orphanage she came from overseas. Self-harm via cutting and restricting food intake became a regular routine for Ayana as she aimed to manage the only thing she could, in theory, control. When her adoptive parents, the Thorntons, first adopted her at age 4, she would vacillate between being excessively clingy and hitting and then running away. To this day, she exhibits a similar pattern of indiscriminate closeness with strangers and emotionally pushing away her adoptive family and friends. During bouts of dysregulated moods, she vacillates between withdrawal and hiding in her room for hours, and then rageful yelling and put-downs of people. Themes that have emerged from young childhood on continue to surround this approach, avoidance, conflict, and distrust or suspicion of people in general. She talks about not knowing where she fits in, being unwanted and unloved, and readying herself for more rejection and abandonment. Ayana's friendships are at times very deep and intense, only to be followed by periods of sudden rejection of friends in anticipation of future hurt towards her. Ayana often states through fears and tears and anger, "Don't you get it? I just don't care." Though her emotions that you see as a therapist would suggest otherwise. A lot of stuff this girl's trying to sort through. Keep in mind that the impact on her development happened at a young age. It said she was first adopted at age 4. And so it sounds like there's some reactive attachment behaviors that began even then. So there's things that might have happened, even unconsciously on her part, but as a protective mechanism. There's that book, The Body Keeps Score. And this would be a perfect example of that. How someone possibly in an orphanage with delayed development, maybe regression, distrust, not knowing who to be close to or not, could even in a good, healthy situation, and even in the midst of affirmation, be convinced that they really can't trust anyone. I had a situation recently where I had a family who had adopted someone, and that girl, when she was a teenager, actually made some pretty major allegations that were not true, that the adoptive parents were beating her. She even went so far as to research and paint her face with makeup in such a way to show as if she had bruises. Later it came out when she realized the impact of people having to follow through on these allegations of abuse against the adoptive parents, that she's like, oh my, what am I doing? And so this is not abnormal for someone who has no sense of normal. That's why you see this emotional regulation is such an important, critical piece of what we do. Keep in mind, even an adult, like I saw one gentleman the other day who could not even put basic words on emotions, like happy, sad, mad, you know, these might be things that are very tough or skills that never have been developed for some of our clients. We can't assume just because someone's a certain age that they know that. We may have to teach that. Let's look at number 3. Corrine grew up in a home where her stepdad Matthew appeared kind and loving to all outside the home. However, Corrine described having an inner hatred of him and begged her mother to not have him be home alone watching. Corrine's mom, Angie, just reasoned that it was because the stepdad Matthew was a bit stricter than her. Over several months, Corrine continued to have a feeling of being yucky around her stepdad. Though he never beat her or disciplined her harshly, she reported looks that felt creepy when she was changing her clothes. Also, she mentioned to a friend that her stepdad would happen to brush up against her breasts or touch her behind as he passed by. Lately, he seemed to make an increasing amount of comments to her about being his little cutie and even touched under her clothes a few times when hugging her. Corrine mentioned to friends about weird feelings about her stepdad. A few of them also stated they did not like their step-parents a lot, but it was mainly because of the differences in rules or missing their other parent when there was a divorce. In a children of divorce group at school, it became increasingly clear that Corrine might be dealing with more than just divorce and blended family issues. She began wearing baggy clothes to school and multiple layers of clothes, including heavy sweaters and coats. She sat nearly all the time with her arms crossed or huddled in a ball to protect herself. When the school counselor tried to check in with her mom, Angie, Angie minimized any concern and highlighted it was simply a preteen girl having to get used to a new dad figure in her life. How would you, if you were the counselor, handle this? Well, first of all, there's nothing like starting with where the client is at. We have to hear their narrative. That's the first step, is creating an environment in which is safe for that to happen. It sounds like that divorce group in the school did that. But unfortunately, the biological mom, probably because of being so excited about being in her own relationship with the stepdad, was blind or was dismissive of Corrine's feelings. So we have to hear and be able to empathize with and normalize that there's something here, there's something going on that's important, and hear that narrative. Also, we have to create a situation where there is ability to tell more of the narrative and what wishes or things the client would want from this point on. For example, with the baggy clothes, that might tell me, you know, is there an issue with cutting? Or is there a body image issue that this person's trying to cover over? Is there something like that we need to explore? And then there's an issue for Corrine about who can she go to? Who are safe people? If her mom's not a safe person and she's tried to go to her, who would she go to? Let's look at a next situation here. Jonathan desires to meet the woman of his dreams and settle down one day. As a hard-working young man, he plans to prepare so he can be ready for a family when the day comes. However, it seems that in every relationship he's in, at some point he becomes defensive and overly reactive. He talks about the women not being a team anymore and just changing on him. During these times, he has flashbacks of when his father would be negative, loud, and demeaning to him. Shame rises up within him again. The internal voice in his head reminds him, "You'll never be good enough. You can't work hard enough. Your efforts are in vain. Just look at you." Jonathan then gets in depressive episodes where he considers himself a failure and has passive suicidal thoughts of wishing he would just not wake up. On a few occasions, he's even considered actual plans for self-harm. A part of him believes and hopes for a better future, but another part of him is stuck in believing he will never measure up to anyone's expectations. The thing that first really jumps out at me about this is just the shame. Any time that repeatedly our client gets in that thing of you're not, you don't measure up, look at you, you're awful, and we hear how they've fallen short, this lays the groundwork for some cognitive behavioral work to be done, specifically some shame-informed cognitive behavioral work. Of course, there's some depressive types of things, so we need to definitely make sure we've done a risk assessment and that there's safety sort of issues. If he has a past history of wishing he would not wake up, if he's in the past considered actual plans for self-harm, this needs to be one of our most important immediate concerns, is regularly checking and see where he's at with that. There's a sense of comparison. He talks about not measuring up to other people's expectations. And we need to look at the idea of if these expectations are healthy. Are they rational? Are they reasonable? Maybe teach him some cognitive debating skills about how he can challenge about why, you know, why according to that other person is their point of view, is their idea about what he should be the truth. Are they being reasonable? Let's look at the next example here. Tony recalls the way in which his dad correcting him. Though Tony admits he was a handful, he grew up feeling, I'm the worst human being in the world. Sure, he'd escape the house at night or run around with friends for days drinking beer and hanging out with girls, but who doesn't do that? Tony recalls his dad grabbing him by the neck and pinning him against the wall while giving him a good talking to. He also recalls the two of them fighting man to man when he was a 16 to 18 year old. One day, I thought my dad was such an evil SOB, he said. I even thought of killing him in his sleep one night. But then something was like, why should you pay for what he's done? To this day, Tony struggles with male authority. On his job, he butts heads with male supervisors and has cussed many a supervisor out or threatened to get physical with a coworker. Tony always feels ready for action to show the world that he ain't no coward. How do you work with him? So it's interesting that there's this sense of reactivity. Initially, I think of that fight, flight, or freeze, and maybe providing some education on that, because it sounds like a lot of times his reaction, whether physically or verbally, is to fight. I imagine that there's some kind of internal beliefs that he has regarding the importance of self-protection, of feeling like, shoot, Dad wasn't there to protect him. If anything, Dad was there to set him straight and get violent with him, that they would fight man to man. He doesn't feel like people in position of authority, such as supervisors on jobs, co-workers, or other people, are someone that he can respect enough to be able to have a legitimate, healthy discussion. So there's a lot of fear about vulnerability. I know he may or may not use the word fear. That might be hard to talk about, but he may admit to some anger. So I think kind of looking at things, you know, he makes a comment, sure, I'd escape the house at night or run around with friends, drinking beer and hanging out with girls, but who doesn't do that? And so I wonder if there's some rationalization. And if you remember back in some of the earlier slides, we talked about how whether a behavior's totally helpful or not, when someone's in trauma mode, the behavior is serving for them at that time a coping purpose. Drinking beer, running around outside, meant he was not having to be inside with Dad. Running around with the women and hanging out with girls meant that he was in a connected relationship. Maybe not with authentic intimacy, but it was not being around Dad. So you see how it's almost like a substitute for something else. Let's look at the next example. Lucy always seems to get attention as she walks by groups of people. In tight-fitting, skimpy outfits, she flirtatiously says, if you got it, flaunt it is what I say. She adds, one thing I learned early on is that while I may not have the intelligence and know-how in some areas, I have a body to die for. Let me repeat that. While I may not have the intelligence, I know that I have a body to die for, is what she said. Lucy recounts a history of many impulsive relationships with men that she barely knew. Substance use and spending sprees, trying to feel fulfilled but only ending up empty inside. I'm tired of feeling like everyone thinks I'm the town whore, she says. Lucy mentions one day, I'm honestly not trying to steal everyone's boyfriends and husbands. I just want love like everyone else. When asked about what a real relationship would look like to her, she describes a family of origin with anxious and avoidant attachment and no concept of what genuine intimacy looks like. How would you approach this in counseling? What's interesting is, as defensive as the tone might be surrounding her words, well, it's not my fault, you got it flaunted. Actually, underlying that, there may be an awful lot of truth. So this again highlights the value of us listening to our client's narrative, that she's wanting attachment and relationship just like anyone else, but just not sure how to get there. She's searching. I think a good starting point would be affirming that she's searching, affirming that she hasn't given up. I have had a number of girls, for example, that I've counseled who sometimes have told me about the relationships they've been in and how unfulfilling they are, but how they feel like they're stuck in this cycle. And one of the things that I try to highlight early on is, instead of giving the perception like, wow, how in the world could you do that, is to say, you know what, for what it's worth, I really want to commend you for even having enough self-respect to search, to realize that I might not have these certain skills, but I want to try and find a way to connect with someone. There probably were some shame-based messages as well in her history. If she's saying things like, I might not have intelligence, but I have this other stuff, she probably was told in certain ways at certain times by significant people in her life, oh, you're not this or you're not that. To where she thought, it's not even worth it to try to be more intelligent or study more. I might as well try and have another way of getting to relationships. Let's look at another example here. A devout Christian couple who is active in ministry for years gives birth to a son without arms and with stubs for feet. This causes them to have to reevaluate the faith they have known and taught so many people about. From the moment he was born, they had to consider how daily tasks like bathing, brushing teeth, and eating could have been done. Even walking through the house could prove a dangerous feat. What would this mean if and when their son grows up, in terms of survival, social and interpersonal relationships, employment, and just getting through the day for years? How could the couple best support their son and give him a reasonable chance at life when they're stretched emotionally themselves? So one of the things that jumps out at me initially is the idea of the acceptance and commitment therapy. The idea that if they're saying they're a devout Christian couple, and if their ministry and their life is centering around their beliefs and their faith, that this might be a starting point of saying, okay, it sounds like there's some values that you espouse dearly, but that when your son had these impairments, that it really was a challenge to your values. And I also hear a lot of grief and the meaning-making component of how do I make sense of this? What explanation do I give myself to get through it and the trauma? What explanation do I give the world when people ask, why in the world is this happening to you? And we go back to the whole thing of vulnerability. I think that sometimes our clients need to hear that it doesn't make them less spiritual. It doesn't make them less quote unquote strong, but makes them just human. If they're crying, if they're angry, if they have questions, if they don't understand something, there's probably a lot of wrestling inside about how could we end up with this kid? What does this mean? What does life hold for us? I also imagine there may be issues about the sense of fairness or unfairness. A lot of times our clients have these issues of if someone is good and righteous and moral and ethical, that good things should happen to them. And bad things should happen to, quote, bad people who do bad choices. But to say, wow, our son was born with these issues, and we feel like we've been serving God and doing great things, what a payback. So that could be an area we might need to explore with the client about that value of fairness and how that's met or not met. Let's look at our next example here. Marla comes home from a long night on the job, tired and ready to go straight to sleep. She stumbles over what she initially believes is a shadow near her bed. Soon thereafter, she realizes the shadow was actually her boyfriend, Juan, hunched over against the bed. She initially assumes he must have passed out after drinking or just not made it all the way to bed. But after repeatedly yelling, she recognized that she has gotten no response. Upon turning on the light, she sees Juan hunched over with blood dripping from his head. There's a piece of paper next to him that she later finds out is a suicide note. Maria knew Juan has been through several stressful life events, but recalls how just the other day the two of them were dreaming and committing to how they'd be moving beyond the current stuckness toward the future of their dreams. So when you think of the definition of trauma, a lot of times the first thing that we think of is shock, something like this. Imagine discovering a suicide, a homicide. What a shock to your system. And again, the meaning making and the wrestling she's going through of how could we just have been dreaming about things and then what happened that now he's at this point. Then when it finally hits, after that initial shock that he's not coming back, that those dreams we discussed are not going to happen, what a mixture, a flood of emotion. Basically, I think sometimes we need to give our clients permission to go through the wrestling. We need to let them not feel like we're another person that's giving them what I call those bumper sticker answers. Those easy, quick, oh, you should do A, B, and C. We need to let them figure out what they need to do to grieve. And we need to reassure them that we'll be with them through the process. Even when that process is difficult, even when it's long, even when we don't understand it. And that they can let us know as we go through counseling when we need to slow things down, when we need to take a different pace or consider other approaches, but that we want to walk alongside them in this journey. Let's look at a few more examples and we'll be wrapping things up here. Jennifer sits in an empty room, which has remained untouched for 1 year. Today is the anniversary of the due date of the child who she miscarried at 21 weeks. Sitting in the recliner, she rocks and rocks, singing lullabies and talking to her little blessing. While friends and relatives cannot understand why she doesn't just make the most of the children she has, she vows to always preserve little Emma's room as much as she has the other children. Feeling misunderstood and as if people are greatly minimizing the pain she lives with, Jennifer vacillates between being numb, having a burst of tears, and rage at those who are insensitive for her disenfranchised grief. So I think one of the things we provide to many of our clients is an understanding of grief, that grief is not linear. I always tell my clients that initially we used to be trained about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of death and dying, but we know that it's not you do step number one, then step two, then step three, and then letting go. I even tell many of my clients that I tend personally to not really like the phrase letting go, but think of more things as reconceptualizing what form or what way we want to remember people, places, and things. Part of it is looking at, you know, what she needs. Also equipping her to be able to answer within herself at any given moment, and even when it changes throughout the day, what she needs in terms of grief. It's okay also to assist her in giving herself permission to be angry with these short, cliche, bumper sticker answers people try to give. And really normalizing some of that. Also letting her know that there is not necessarily any certain time limit. Now our next case here, we have Martin. Martin comes in for initial counseling sessions, recounting the details that led up to his leave time from work. He describes how it was supposed to be, quote, like any other, but ended out to be far different. As he arrived at his client's house to do a check on one of his probation kids, he did not hear anything. Interestingly enough, he had just minutes before been speaking with that probation kid on the phone to confirm their visit. However, after much time ringing the doorbell and knocking, Martin came to realize the door was unlocked. Calling out to the client, he still did not hear anything from the client or anyone else in the home. Later, he saw more than he bargained for. Checking on his probation clients became the shock of his life, finding the discovery of a client who had hung himself and could not stand being a disappointment to people anymore. One of the things where we can be especially sensitive to our clients is the idea that narratives can change in a heartbeat. Narratives are, and life in general is not logical. I tend to tell people that grief, shock, surprise, death are not things that are just linear. I say, you know what? I hope that if someone went through what you went through, that it would be seen as something that's life-changing. And I'll mention for you to say, oh, I should just be the same as if nothing happened, is unrealistic, because it has changed. Because doing your job as a probation officer meant something to you. And the meaning behind that changed that day. in a way that you never could have bargained. Let's look at this last example here. Lynn cried, stating that she's tried so hard to be someone that others could love. She would give her all in relationships, thinking maybe one day someone would stay. However, she kept finding out that in the process, she changed and accommodated so much to others that she no longer even recognized who she was anymore. Fearing rejection and abandonment, she pushed away anything that felt vulnerable and approaching the intimacy she desired. This reminds me of what we talked about in terms of codependency, that sense of limerence, that sense of changing and adapting to become who or what someone else might want us to be. The idea that, well, I don't know if I really initially agree with them, but somewhere in my mindset, I think, well, I guess I'll just go along with it. And then later, ending up angry and resentful. So some cognitive behavioral therapy might be very helpful with her in terms of helping identify the often unspoken but nonetheless strong messages about codependency. Be good, be right, be strong, be perfect. Be what you think other people need. And then finding out that this may or may not really work in the long run. I oftentimes, if someone's dealing with codependency, refer to books like Codependent No More and Language of Letting Go. So the idea of reconceptualizing life not with dependency or not with independency, but interdependency. Also looking at assertiveness and boundaries. Having to reconceptualize what intimacy should be or shouldn't be. And really grieving that loss of, ooh, I thought this meant this, but maybe it means something different. We also hear her talking about fearing rejection and abandonment. So it's almost like she went from approaching the relationship so strongly because she didn't want to lose it, to now, after this relationship, just realizing, like, you know what? Huh, forget relationships. I'm going to be on the defensive because I'm not going to be hurt again. I'm not going to jump through all these hoops and no one do this for me. So vulnerability, again, is very core. One thing I hope you see in terms of these examples that we're doing with the case conceptualizations is the idea, again, as we started with in the first portion of today's seminar, that when we're looking at defining what is trauma, that it's really not just a simple formula, that it's about anything from disenfranchised grief over the death of a child at 21 weeks in the womb, or someone losing their identity or their expectation of a relationship or a job, someone being hurt or abused, whether it's physically or emotionally, someone facing vulnerability. And keep in mind that a lot of times, it's not just one thing. There's several co-occurring and often overwhelming narratives that our clients are dealing with. Just trying to remotely make sense of how in the world do I focus on any of this. So just keep in mind that the work we do, how utterly important that is in hearing the client's narrative and walking alongside him or her. And also, when needed, us getting the help we do to be able to be the best listeners and help them in their journey at the pace that they need. Thank you for joining me and walking alongside me as we really explored a difficult topic in terms of transforming trauma. Make sure if you're listening to this for your home study credits for continuing education to go on the website to take the mandatory board-required true-false test. You'll go on the website www.rolpc.org and then go to the home study test portion. On there, you'll take the home study test. It'll be submitted to us at River of Life, and it'll be date and time stamped. And that will be the day that will be listed on the certificate of completion for today's seminar. If you do have any other questions, feel free to give us a call at 614-353-4157. And we wish you well in your endeavors as a mental health professional. Thank you. Bye.